So you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM, and it is time, as on every Tuesday at 5 o'clock, for Office Hour. Before we begin today, I just wanted to remind you that the views contained in this hour may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So as we do every Tuesday at 5 o'clock here on Office Hour, this is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. We go around the campus and we knock on doors to find out, what are people doing in all of these buildings? What's happening? What are they thinking about? What can they tell us about what does it mean to be human? What lofty and theoretical thoughts have they been struggling with? What practical suggestions do they have for how to live our life? So I'm very excited today. We're going to be knocking on the door of the communications department, and we're going to welcome to the show Seth Fry, who is new to campus in communications. So welcome to the show, Seth.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Okay. And Seth is going to talk about something called self-governing communities, which may sound rather strange to you, but it turns out we all belong to many, many, many different self-governing communities. And maybe since we belong to them, we should have some idea about how do they work? How do they function? So we're going to help you understand that better today. Now, as always, before we go into this particular research, we always ask our guests how they became interested in the particular topics. And this is a very important question for me, because I'm not sure that someone wakes up one morning and says, I want to study large populations and self-governing communities and how people develop notions of justice in groups and things like that. And Seth has a fairly eclectic program, having come out of departments of computer science, it's called Computer Science and Information Science, and having moved into a department called Communications. So Seth, tell us a little bit about how you became interested in these topics, so we can understand how you're placed then today in communications.
Sure. Well, I gotta say, I'm tremendously jealous of the people who seem like, you know, they popped out of the womb and crawled up their mother's breasts and said, "I want to study. I'm gonna be this when I grow up."
Uh-huh.
I after graduating from college with a degree in cognitive science, which I only picked because you were forced to take classes in six different departments. I just wanted to learn everything. I was lost. I wandered the earth, substitute teaching and bookbinding. I worked in rare books a little bit. And then was sort of, I got fired one day by from this volunteer publishing gig run by Buddhists. I got fired by Buddhists and spent 3 days depressed in bed, decided that I was going to overcome my intimidation of being a scientist because I love science so much. So I went to grad school studying cognitive science basically because it had been my undergrad.
Uh-huh.
And the whole while living in community, living in cooperative housing is something Davis actually has a lot of. This has just been like a parallel track in my life. In addition to trying to always learn cool stuff, I've been living in community. So sharing a house with lots of people, cooking meals for each other, going shopping for each other, having lots of conflict, cleaning bathrooms for each other, great relationships and friendships, and having meetings that just go on and on and on. Because
yes,
democracy is pretty slow,
mm-hmm,
and contentious and difficult. You just got to talk everything over. So I was in grad school studying cognitive science, group behavior kind of model, pretty abstract experiments. When I met this really important woman in my life and the lives of a lot of people, her name is Eleanor Ostrom. She's the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in economics, and she won it largely for developing a sort of science of cooperatives, a science of self-governance.
Mm-hmm.
She focused on international development, farmers running irrigation systems or people sharing forests or lobstermen in Maine, you know, people sharing fisheries. Uh-huh. These are all cases, these are all environments where you need explicit governance to prevent overfishing or over-harvesting or taking too much water. And I realized that all the trouble I'd been having and all the experiences I had, super powerful experiences of the beauty and difficulty of democracy at home, keeping the kitchen sink clean, that there was a science for it, that there was a way to study it systematically.
Mm-hmm.
That completely transformed my trajectory. And ever since, I've been trying to bring more data to the science of cooperation, the science of self-governance.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, I mean, it's striking to me in this story. First of all, I hope any students listening realize that you can graduate from college not knowing what you're going to do, and it still comes out okay later,
yeah.
Right? Right? Because I think sometimes students just freak out when they graduate from college and they're not sure what they want to do next. That something was compellingly interesting to you, maybe in a way you didn't realize, about democracy and living together and trying to make democracy work. I mean, because you lived it.
Yeah.
And I know that all of my friends who ever did anything like that, they always had to really walk the walk, as we say, because it took so much time. As you said, it was incredibly time consuming because you had to have meetings all the time everything to work.
Yeah.
So there was something, I can't imagine it's just by accident that you ended up in this kind of living situation.
Oh, no. I started out, it was just, it turns out to be pretty strange, exciting, interesting people who select that. And,
yes.
And so my first 4 years, actually, yeah, pretty much all of undergrad. That's why I was there. That's what I was in it for. But there was one day I sort of had this epiphany. A friend had made a decision. I think he had chopped down a tree because it was impeding his view without running it by the house because he knew it would never pass. And for some reason, I was super annoyed. I approached him. And he laughed it off in a way that this isn't sequential, but it wasn't sequential when it happened. Made me realize that that I can be a political agent and affect change, and that democracy could be a tool or a vehicle for me to become more than I had imagined for myself.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a very optimistic story, and maybe we need an optimistic story about democracy today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, maybe today is, starting on January in 2019 with the government shut down as it is. Maybe we need today to be thinking about it. So what happens from this sort of a very personal story of being involved in a lot of meetings and seeing yourself as a political agent, what you've gone on to do is then study how communities self-govern. Now, I think about this, too, as having sort of a more historical approach, that there's lots of different ways of studying how communities take care of themselves and self-govern. What's interesting to me is that you kind of look for a sped-up version. You want sort of a sped-up version of a community. You don't want to follow a human lifespan or a governmental lifespan.
Yeah.
So you turn to gaming, because in gaming, I presume you get to see all these processes much more quickly and you also just have a lot of data?
Well, we can slow down a little bit. So I use data from the internet to study self-organizing communities. It turns out there's a lot of them there, and you have really easy access to them.
Right.
And the historical perspective, it takes a lifetime to become an expert in one democracy, to really understand its roots, and you could... And people do spend entire lifetimes just learning one system. So anyone who wants to do comparative historical work, maybe between two systems, could really spend two lifetimes. Now, if I want to understand the range of outcomes of democracies, all the ways that can be successful, because each one is a beautiful flower, right? So there's a huge number of ways that a group of people can come together and make something that works, that really empowers all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Then... I guess I would need to understand thousands of democracies backwards and forwards, thousands of lifetimes. You know what I would really need? The perfect tool would be just if I could sort of take the whole Earth, rewind history, have all this power to change things a little bit, replay history, see what happened,
check it out,
rewind it again.
Yeah, compare.
Yeah, and then just do that thousands or millions of times. And in this world, even so you're in religious studies, yeah? In this world, even a scholar of religious studies is an experimentalist.
Yes.
Because they can change the world, rerun it. And that sounds fanciful until you look at the internet. There's all these isolated communities. They don't talk to anybody else. And they're just trying stuff out. And games, specifically, are these little fake worlds that are totally identical to each other in every instantiation. And if you just watch how they evolve over a couple of weeks, a lot of games are done in a couple of weeks, then you've watched from birth to death the entire process of a democracy, some sense of self-governance succeed, or any kind of government. You see autocracies, democracies, anarchies, all of them in the same little world, mm-hmm. From birth to death. The range of outcomes, how successful they were, and you can look into what made them successful.
Mm-hmm. So the world of gaming is a great testing ground, you're telling us, which I suspect that many of our listeners have never really thought about this before, but it's a great place to test self-governance, how communities come to be, what happens when they exist, and how they come to an end. I'm curious to explain to everybody, how do you get the data from these communities?
Yeah.
I mean, do you do it mostly through questionnaires, or is there any data that's just sort of automatically recorded? Do you have to go out and sort of ask people for their conceptions of what's going on?
I don't do any questionnaires. I don't do mostly. I pretty much don't do any asking. And this gets a little bit at a funny point of how it is that there's self-governance in gaming. A lot of games are single player. A lot of games are pretty complete within them. But what ends up happening when people get excited about a game, they build a community around it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what I end up studying is the governance of the community around a game. It could be a guild in Warcraft. This is a group of people who like to go into dungeons together, and they end up building these very militaristic hierarchies that require constant management. Blizzard, which is the company that developed Warcraft, they didn't build guilds into the game. Guilds emerged around the ecosystem of the game. They're essentially necessitated by the demands of the game, which the game designers themselves never anticipated happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so the governance kind of happens outside the game. It's the same in Minecraft. Minecraft, to play a multiplayer game, a lot of people log on to a server, a computer. That computer is usually owned by a company, but a funny thing about Minecraft is when you log into a server, it's not run by a company. It's usually run by an amateur. There's hundreds of thousands of amateur-run Minecraft servers.
Mm-hmm.
And Minecraft is a resource-intensive game, which means the computer you're probably on right now, listener, is, I don't know, 2 gigabytes, 4 gigabytes, 8 gigabytes of RAM. To run a Minecraft server, every additional player requires you to have another half gig or single gig of RAM. So to have 8 people playing together is going to destroy your computer. Is gonna slow your computer down to the point where no one can play. So to run a large community doesn't just take a lot of resources. It takes very active management of a physical resource, the resources of your computer.
Mm-hmm,
and the person,
mm-hmm.
So suddenly the person running the game, they just started this community so they could play a game, but suddenly they have to think about resource management the same way that fisheries have to think about overfishing and that farmers have to think about sharing water.
Uh-huh.
So that's where governance comes in, is the ecosystem around the game.
Uh-huh. And
The data. The data is also made available by the ecosystem around the game. The ecosystem around Minecraft, there's these hundreds of thousands of servers all around the world. No one knows how they can find them. So random people just started making lists of Minecraft servers. And you would go to those lists to figure out what server to go to. And then some lists were better than others. Some lists were really interactive. They didn't just list the IP address, the URL. They also said how many people are on at that moment and what kind of server community is it and all this stuff. And in order to get that information, the community around the game wrote what's called an API. They wrote a way for those lists to talk to those servers, to learn about those servers on the fly in real time. And so I just sort of plugged into that communication channel.
You listened. You overheard.
Yeah, I just listened. to all these conversations between these server lists and these hundreds and thousands of communities to learn about them, to learn all those communities. It turns out they just happened to reveal a lot of information about how successful they were, about what kind of people they attract, about what kind of literal government they run.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just want to repeat one of the points that you made so we can all make sure we understand it, which is that a lot of what happens is not anticipated by the people who've designed these games.
Not at all.
So the unintended consequences. So someone will design a game, but then it's the people who play it who literally create it. In the same way, the people create all kinds of other kinds of communities, but you can see it there and you can listen to it and you can hear them all talking back and forth. So now you've got this all of this data about it. The question is, what do you learn and how does that relate from what you learned in gaming to how does that relate to the self-governing communities outside?
Okay.
So let's start first with just what do you learn about these communities themselves? So we've got all of these people, thousands of people, all hooked up together, cooperating because they all want to have a good game experience. What do you think is kind of the most important push behind the cooperation? Do they sort of have it's really an idea that they all want to play together well?
That's a nice thing about using games is you can off the bat assume that people are highly motivated to accomplish goals within the game. So they're coming with strong motivation.
Yeah.
And in the case of a multiplayer game like Minecraft or Warcraft, you literally can't succeed at the thing you're highly motivated to succeed at without cooperating with a bunch of people. It's the same at Minecraft. So I can kind of go in assuming that they have this sort of, I'll say, instrumentalist desire to work with others towards a common goal.
Mm-hmm.
There's beautiful. I'm not personally actually a huge gamer myself, but when I hop on the Minecraft servers, there are literally beautiful, awe-inspiring constructions people have built. Scale models of historical buildings, a scale model replica of the Starship Enterprise. People just do beautiful things together they never could have done alone.
Okay. I'm still kind of interested in your question around motivation.
Yeah.
Or maybe you don't care. I mean, maybe your only question is if their motivation is to just have a good gaming experience. Or do you think there's any other way in which they're generalizable about why, you know, what they want out of this? Because the idea is that this kind of motivation might actually shape what they're trying to get out of the game.
Right. Yeah, it's not just the fact of motivation, but motivation to accomplish X.
Right.
And the nice thing about games, because they're these little design societies with very restricted choice sets and very narrow path and a very clear goal, is I don't just know they're highly motivated. I know what goal they're motivated to accomplish. And that makes it possible as a scientist to like, make a lot more inferences about what they were working towards when they did action X instead of Y.
Okay. And you can be fairly specific in terms of enumerating what their goal is, like their goal is to get this next level in the game.
Right. So the goal of the administrator is not just to, for a lot of the smaller servers I looked at, is not just to get a bunch of people, but get a bunch of people coming back regularly.
Uh-huh. Because again, that makes the game better.
And it takes an administrator time and money and resources and stress to run a successful server. It takes a lot of work. They wouldn't be doing it if nobody came or if people never came back.
Okay. Well, before we move on to we start the first of the $264,000 question, which is what do you learn about groups of people? What do we learn about how they regulate themselves? I'm just curious as to whether you think this is a research in a rather specific type of person.
Hmm.
How generalizable do you think the results that you're now going to explain to us are?
Yeah.
Or do you think that these people who, for example, having experience in my own family, are they more likely to be people who are highly participatory to start with, highly self-regulating, less self-regulating? Is there any way in which we can characterize the nature of the people who become part of these specific self-governing communities?
So it's natural before getting to the $64,000 question, you would ask the million-dollar question. Generalizability is the question, not just because the subject pool is specific, but because the problem domain is so strange. What can online interactions, what can the digital realm really tell us about high stakes life altering changes in the real world. To get to, let's see, how do I explain this? So I can ask a question. It's really easy to find questions online that aren't likely to generalize, that aren't likely to tell us about anything outside of that domain. So a lot of people who study Twitter, you can kind of call them, they think of themselves as social scientists, but you can kind of call them Twitterologists.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
However, there are certain questions you can ask, and this is purely what I keep my eye open for when I'm looking for good questions is questions that are likely to generalize. So here's what I'm going to do. Here's my strategy for finding a question that'll generalize outside the online domain. I'm going to look for something that in the real world is really hard to do. And I'm going to find a problem online or a population online that would make that really hard thing to do even harder.
Uh-huh.
And if I can find a thing that as hard as this is doing in the real world is even harder online, and on top of that, I can find the people online doing it successfully, even though it's extra hard, then I have a little bit of an argument that they're doing something right. They're doing something that we can learn about in the real world.
Uh-huh.
So that's my setup. Now let's get into specifics.
Okay.
Democracy, cooperation is pretty hard in the real life. I've tried to run book clubs before. No one reads the book. I've tried to keep a kitchen sink clean in a co-op before, and it doesn't happen.
Right.
That's hard. Now, let's do that exact same thing with this group of people who they're young. They're younger than me. They're younger than the college student. The median age of Minecraft players is going to be 19.
Wow.
And they're also anonymous, so they have no way of really keeping each other accountable. If your friends, you know, do something bad to you, you'll see them the next day and you can smack them upside the head, you can chew them out, you have recourse. Right. But a random other person on the internet, there's nothing you can do.
So we've
got young, we've got anonymous, and I'm going to say male. Yeah, it's mostly about 85% of players in Minecraft are men or boys.
Okay.
So let's think about this. Young, anonymous, boy teenagers are arguably, as a population, I don't know, sort of like the hardest to govern people on Earth. And self-governance, no less. I mean, that's the whole thesis. If you treat Lord of the Flies
exactly
right,
that's hovering back
as political theory,
right?
Then the hypothesis of political theorists is that adolescents are incapable of successfully governing themselves,
and they're going to end up with murder.
Murder.
Yeah, that's where you're going to end up. That's kind of the bottom line. You're going to end up murdering each other. Yes, it's funny because I was I was talking with somebody in the army, and he was saying that that's also a problem in the army, that if you get together a group of 18-year-olds, he said, you know, my mother would always say a group of 18-year-old boys would just come up with dumb ideas, and that turned out to be true. and that's part of the issue in terms of the military trying to get a group of guys of 18 with bad ideas to cooperate together. Whoa. So this question comes up in many realms in society. So, but here we're talking about, we've got this all set up, the gaming is going, and what you end up then finding in terms of the close set of conclusions is that they do cooperate, and that democracy is important.
Right. And this is where Minecraft stops being a game and starts being kind of astounding. We have these little successful experiments in governance run entirely by people who have no accountability to each other, and a lot of predisposition, a lot of reason to not be good to each other, to not work together. And so my studies, this series of work focuses mostly on the administrators. What decisions are they making to more effectively herd the cats?
Mm-hmm.
And what I find is that most of these communities actually do fail. There are a lot of failures, but there's so many of them that there's still thousands and thousands of successes. I see about 20% of these communities succeed in the sense that they're able to get more than one person coming back at least once a week for a month. Mm-hmm. The lifespan of the game is pretty short. So you've played for a month or two and you're kind of done. And then you reset and kind of start over again. And the administrators, they can install a variety of rules. And this is another of the exciting things looking from the administrator's perspective at this game, is that governance, because of the ecosystem of players around the game, has been reduced to sort of flipping little switches of different governance modules. You can, by default, there's no rules on the server. It's this infinite world, totally unconstrained, and you can do whatever you want. So there's no rules, and there's one ruler. The administrator can turn it off, turn it on, and change it. I sort of had to make up a vocabulary term, tyranno-anarchy. It's a tyrant with no rules by default. And then they can turn rules on. There's a switch, essentially, you can flip to turn on social hierarchy, to turn on private property rights, to turn on peer-to-peer communication or centralized communication, message passing, peer monitoring, peer enforcement, reporting systems, you know, and all of these are little modules that collectively form customized governments.
So and they do. They turn them on.
They do. They flip all kinds of switches. And what's happening, you can think of it, the administrator, they have no governance experience, right? They're game players. They weren't looking to govern. But everyone has what we can call a sort of folk theory of utopia, this naive theory of what brings people together, you know?
What they think will be good, and they're in charge of it. They're the god in that realm.
Exactly.
And they can try to institute it. But why do you call it a utopia?
Well, because it sounds really cool, but also because it is, you know, you wouldn't start a server if you didn't think that it would... You wouldn't put all the effort in if you didn't think it would lead to something really exciting, empowering for you, for everybody, to something more than you could do alone. You wouldn't do it if you didn't have this vision of a group of people coming together.
So at least an ideal, if not a utopia, something that would be really good and really enjoyable and really fun.
We can say folk theory of community building, folk theory of bringing people together, folk theory of a bunch of pals. They have this naive sense of what it is that brings people together. And I'm there. I'm watching. I'm listening. When a person first puts their community online, first connects it to a list, and I see what their first set of rules were, their first government was, and I can watch over time. I can see. I watched a lot of these communities for 2 years. I can see. Were they successful? Did it take off? And if they failed, what tweaks did they institute to make it suddenly succeed? Mm-hmm. So I can see not just the rules people think will be effective, but because I'm watching over time, the rules that actually turned out to have been effective.
Terrific. Okay, well, we have reached the end of segment one today on Office Hour. So we're going to take a quick break. And then we're going to come back and talk more with Seth Frye about what we can learn about democracy from online gaming and from a group of 18-year-old guys who are trying to make something that's going to function. They're trying to set that up. So stay with us, and we will be back in just a minute. Okay, so you are back now for the second half of Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and we are talking today with Seth Frye from the Department of Communications, brand new professor, hot off the press, from just came this year to Davis, and talking about the studies that he's doing to try to understand how people govern themselves in communities by using the example of online gaming. And as he was saying in the first half, he's able to study and listen in on, one could say, thousands of mini democracies being built, coming into existence, and then being destroyed. Now, I don't know if we would call them democracies, as you were saying. They're really run by one person, the person who runs the server. So where we left off was that when you hear this all, one of the things that you learn, much to your surprise, is that these groups try to, in fact, to govern themselves. They, in fact, try to set up things that we might see along the lines of, I don't know if you go so far as a traditional notions of something like, what do we have in a community? We want to have fair. We want to have a community that's fair. That's one of the things we sort of think as the undergirding of democracy. Yeah. We want to have one in which there is justice and equity, and that these same kinds of things turn out to become issues in online gaming, as unexpectedly.
Yeah. Another thing that's really important is effectiveness. Am I having a good experience online? Comes down to also running the physical computer in a way that's effective. And so there's many things we look for in a society. Mm-hmm. We look for societies that are fair. We look for societies that, I don't know, are kind of predictable. Like, I know what's going to happen tomorrow. Or I know if I do A, what B is going to be. We look for societies that it's called social efficiency is what economists call it. But sort of that of all the outcomes that are that sort of the resources are being used well, that mm-hmm. we're not squandering. A society can be fair with all the resources in the sense that we all have nothing. That would be an inefficient but fair society.
Equitable. Right. Unfortunately, equitable, right?
Exactly. And that's the really exciting thing that's another really exciting thing about Minecraft. We have these hundreds of thousands of societies, these little tiny experimental, minimally social societies run by a bunch of different people with a bunch of different ideas of what makes an effective community. And as a player, you sort of suddenly get to shop around. Mm-hmm. You get to see, you try this one and log on to that one, log on to this one, log on to that one, and explore what you look for in a social system and find the values you like. And you can self-select into this instead of that kind of community and find other people who have self-selected into this instead of that kind of community.
Now, I imagine one of the things that you study then is as communities become more complex. So we're going to come back to that. But before we look at that, which is, again, a very interesting question, how we end up, we always seem to feel we end up with more and more rules, and whether that's also replicated in the world of gaming. I'm wondering about adjudication of conflict.
Yeah.
Because, as you said, one of the ways in which when you were living in these little democratic housing situations, one way which you did it was simply a huge number of meetings in which a lot of stuff was talked through. And I presume that's not the mechanism that's used on online gaming, where they get everybody into the living room and they try to work it through. So how, in fact, do these governments, can you give us some very concrete examples of what is self-governance in a community like that, so that you would even call it self-governance and not just somebody on top making up rules?
Right, right. Well, what I call self-governance, and maybe this is a stretch, is the overall system of lots of different people making up rules. So if I'm wronged somehow, somebody burns down my house, which is something that happens a lot in this game. You can set things on fire. I can complain to the nearest moderator or to the owner of the server and have the person who did it reprimanded or kicked off the server. And if I don't get justice through the means available on the server, I can vote with my feet. I can leave and go mm-hmm. to another server that I think mm-hmm. is going to treat me well. And what ends up happening is there's a lot of players of the game, but not that many of them are what you might call good community members. There's lots of bad behavior, and it takes a special person. It's not everybody who's really wants to work together with you to build something more than either you could have done alone. That's inspiring. So there's essentially competition between these different communities, between these different administrators, for good, like, citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates an incentive for administrators to not be autocrats, to not be dictators, but to really listen to what their members are asking for. So because of the existence of competition between servers, what you get as an incentive of these tyrants, these little tyrants, to act as if their little autocracies are democracies, mm-hmm. to behave outside the formal structure of their organization, which is hierarchical, to behave as if it's more than that, which means listening to what your citizens want and giving that to them and, mm-hmm. and working hard to keep them happy.
That's a very complicated idea, I think.
It is.
I think if you actually think about what you just said, I think it's worth for our listeners to really to think about that for a little bit, because it's a very bold argument to make. That when people come together in groups, there are incentives, and they're not necessarily simply financial incentives, for the people who end up in the roles of government to try to do good government. That there's actually sort of could one say a sort of just an evolutionary group incentive to for leaders to serve people well enough that they end up having a community to be in charge of? Would you be willing to make that argument?
No, I would say there's a lot of evidence that you just give somebody power and they'll abuse it. If there aren't systems in place to check that power, you have some great natural experiments that have occurred in international development. You have lab experiments,
right.
You have plenty of historical evidence. But in this game environment, that check isn't really instituted. You could imagine the game designer making sure all their administrators are being good governors, but that would take a lot of work.
Right.
What ends up happening is you have two really bad people with the goal of getting lots of people to come to them. So they're inherently bad, but they've recognized that the only way to get good people to come to them is to pretend they're nice, but to pretend so effectively that they're really hard to tell from really nice people.
Okay. Well, that was sort of what I was trying to say, but it's actually very, very complicated. So let's come back to that again by going at it from another angle, which is at the same time, while all of this is going on, you say bad people are being nice, but so nice that they seem to be good people because they have the incentive. There's an incentive to at least look nice, even if they haven't annulled evilness in their heart, as we say in religion. That at the same time, there's a natural movement towards complexity as well.
Yeah,
that these groups are becoming more complex.
Yeah, I can define all that. So there's two dimensions of complexity. There's the complexity of all the problems you have to solve to be an effective administrator.
Yeah.
And then there's the complexity of all the different ways you could try to solve any one of those problems. So the different kinds of problems that pop up, there's the physical resources you have to manage. Your server has to have enough CPU, RAM, bandwidth, and all these sort of computery things to provide a high bandwidth network service to your players so that they don't have a laggy game experience.
You have to pick up the trash.
Yeah. So these are physical resources that have to be effectively managed. There's also virtual resources. So if you and I want to build an impressive building together, we're going to chop down all the trees nearby. And that means we have to walk farther and farther for trees, or we have to plant more trees. So that's a virtual resource that needs management. Someone's got to take responsibility for planting trees or anything like that. And the third category of resource that has to be managed, you can kind of think of vandalism or bad behavior or bad eggs as a resource that has to be gotten rid of. Good resources you want lots of, bad resources you want a little of. So bad behavior is a resource that has to be managed. So those are three different problems, each of them very difficult, and a successful administrator has to solve all of them.
But then by things becoming increasingly complex, in other words, these three are sort of all interacting with each other, it's never going to get simpler. It's always only going to get more complicated.
The way I define complexity is how many of these problems you're trying to solve. If your goal is only to run a community of three or four people, and I can see that when I listen to these servers talk to each other, then you actually don't need a lot of complexity. You can be focusing on just one of the problems. But as your goal becomes to build a larger and larger community, a community of people in the tens or in the hundreds, you have to more effectively solve all of these problems. So that's one dimension of complexity, that there's more kinds of problems you're solving. You're solving a bigger cocktail of difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
The other dimension of complexity is the ways of solving a given problem. So even governance is hard, and a lot of our efforts at small-scale democracy fail, which is funny because we all think we know. Everyone has an idea of the perfect government. There's a lot of ideology. There's a lot of political ideology is a thing. You have people who say, oh, well, we don't need governments. We can solve all problems using the market.
Right.
You have people who say, oh, we can solve all problems using democracy, or, oh, we can solve all problems using a hierarchy. And you see some of these types reflected in very minimal form in, again, these little switches that administrators can flip.
As they play the game.
So the big takeaway is, You can be very ideological. You can rely and lean very heavily on one type of governance if your goal is to run a small community. But to run it, to run a successful large-scale community, you have to install many, many, many different types of governance modules. You have to pick a very rich, complex government, a very diverse government, a government that is very pragmatic. It's not saying this is my ideology says I should only use this type of rule. You have to use every type of solution you have available.
Well, that also seems to me to be an incredibly complicated idea. That's the second super complicated idea. Of other ideas are just complicated, but that's a super complicated one, because that's making that, again, a kind of an inherent argument that if you're going to have a really complicated world, if we live as human beings in a complicated society and there's a lot of us, we're going to have a lot of rules. Yeah. We're going to have a very elaborate governance system.
This gets back to this woman I mentioned earlier. Her name is Eleanor Ostrom, this important political economist who was recognized as Nobel laureate in economics. So she had this huge influence, and she died 1 year after winning the prize. It was very sad, and it was very strange to hop online and see who was writing eulogies for. You saw some very capitalist groups saying, oh, we lost this amazing advocate for markets. And you saw anarchists saying, oh, we lost this very strong advocate for anarchy. And you saw people who care about democracy saying
lots of people saw her as making an argument for them.
And that's because she promoted this idea called institutional diversity. Institutional diversity is the idea that a successful government, a successful institution, a successful community really has a little bit of everything. It's got a little bit of hierarchy built in. It's got a little bit of democracy built in. It's got a little bit of autocracy. It relies on markets where markets are effective. It relies on a tyrant where tyrants are effective.
And a little bit of anarchy where anarchy is good.
There you go. Exactly. So that's the idea of institutional diversity, which this study of Minecraft, this video game, was able to support at a scale that hadn't been possible before.
Because when you see these people doing Minecraft, they are doing this. They are using a little bit of everything.
And if they didn't, it didn't work. Yeah,
and over and over again. You could see this over and over again.
Yeah, because I had, for this study, 5,000 communities I was able to compare. If I wanted to perform that study over countries, which would be a lot more generalizable, a lot more relevant to our daily lives, well, there's only about 255 countries, and they're all really different from each other.
Yes.
They have very unique histories, and I can't watch those whole histories.
Uh-huh. So looking at a slightly different angle on this whole question of what do you learn from these gaming communities, you also are very interested in this question, which we drove by very quickly, which is norms of fairness.
Yeah.
So how do norms of fairness come in? Because if you're talking about all of these different kinds of things coming in, it's hard to know really how important is it in the scheme of all these issues. How important is fairness? I think that's a very big issue for human beings, all of us as human beings. We want the garbage to be picked up, too. So we do want a certain kind of just efficiency.
Yeah.
You know, think of having grown up in Chicago. What was the worst thing that could happen? The snowstorm. You know, that would bring the mayor. That was often the end of a career. There's nothing like a snowstorm. And you'd think that, you know, that's not really a question of justice or morality or normal or equality. It's just a question of simply logistics of being able to get out your door. So, you know, what can you tell us from your study of the gaming about how does norms of fairness fit into cultural questions?
Yeah, well, this is on a different game, but same general idea. You have a bunch of people in a world working together, and there's lots of worlds. For this other study, we identified a problem that a lot of people have, which is that a random person can say they're going to help you out, and you work together with them for a while until a shiny, valuable object appears.
Mm-hmm.
And then before you can blink an eye, they've stolen it and run away. And it's called ninja-ing in the World of Warcraft community. So that was a problem that all these communities have to solve. And if you ask people, well, what, you know, do Do you face this problem? Yes. What do you do to solve this problem? Well, that question, it turned out, depended on server. You saw a huge amount of diversity across servers on the sort of informal norms and rules they came up with to solve different kinds of problems they face.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask people within a server, within a community, you would always get the same answer. So what happened is you had consensus on what fair means within a community, within all communities, but you had really different conceptions of fairness over all communities. So essentially, people's sense of what a just outcome is and what's the most fair or the most just outcome is looked a lot like what they're currently doing. And presumably, if you'd ask them, oh, what about this other thing that that community is doing? Is that fair? Is that just? Is that more fair or just than what you're doing? The answer you'd get is no. What I'm doing, what my community is doing, that's the right way, that's the right thing to do. So mm-hmm. it's evidence of this acculturation. And it's evidence of, or it might be self-selection, who knows? People who think that way go to the community that agrees
and
with them.
And stay there.
Right, and stay there.
Exactly.
But regardless, you had this sort of emergent cultural diversity. The demographics of people playing this game are pretty comparable. The worlds they're playing in are literally identical. And nevertheless, you have diversity. You have differences across them. You have cultural differences. So imagine the same population, the same world. I brought up this idea of taking Earth, rewinding it, changing something and replaying it millions of times to watch all the ways that history can replay itself. Now imagine doing that, except you didn't change anything.
You just let it be.
We have 20th century history just played out how it did. And we all know how that. Now imagine hitting the rewind button to 1900, January 1st, and replaying it again and finding a completely different outcome.
So you're seeing a lot of contingency is what you're saying.
You're seeing sort of our best explanation was that random little bits of noise getting amplified to drive this emergent diversity between communities.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think it's important to go back and remind ourselves that these are things that the people who put the game together did not control or anticipate.
Yeah.
That so we've got history just going along on its own path. Now, little random bits of noise is pretty obscure for me.
Okay.
I imagine our listeners don't actually know. We get little random bits of noise on the radio, but I'm not sure that that's what you mean. That, you know, something is driving what we call history.
Events. Yeah. Let's say January 1st, we just rewound History of Earth to January 1st, and everything was going, we've done it 1,000 times, and everything kind of goes the same for the first couple days, and all these parallel Earths that are replaying mm-hmm, the 20th mm-hmm, century. Mm-hmm. Except in one of them, someone's coin flip turns out heads instead of tails, and that leads
they
to...
They beat the other person up, and then
yeah,
you end
but,
up in...
And that leads... No, not even a big event, but that leads to just some slightly... That this person has slightly more money that day than the other person. So they buy more cups of coffee or they buy a beer for a friend or something, you know? And so you have a, when I say random bits of noise, I mean small events that could have come out either way, kind of leading or growing or snowballing to have greater and greater effects. So suddenly, 100 years later,
you have a different world.
You have a different world, right.
Right. And so you have all these different worlds playing out in these games, and they all have a drive towards fairness. So can we say that? Would you say that they all have a drive towards fairness?
I would say they all... No, there's a lot of unfair behavior on all these servers. But what they all have are standards, or definitions of what is fair
okay.
and what is just. And those are all different from each other, but they reliably develop some sense of what's just and fair.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the fact for diversity in that is kind of exciting to me because it means that... what I think is just or fair is going to be really different, not just in another society, but in my society, if history had turned out a little bit differently.
Uh-huh.
And this gets it. I really love democracy. I really love the cooperatives I was involved in.
Uh-huh.
I think it's exciting, and I think cooperative models that Davis has a bunch of
yes.
should be replicated and propagated and duplicated. That it would be great if I could just take the rules of a really good co-op that I lived in and just give them to some other group of people, and they follow those rules, and they'll have a great community too.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be the same.
Well, Well, it would be great if it would be, because, you know, we have McDonald's. You know how you get a McDonald's? It's called a franchise. You have this list of rules. McDonald's is its own recipe book. You get this list of rules, and if you follow the rules, you'll have a successful McDonald's. So businesses know how to replicate, and by replicating, businesses have taken over the earth. Hierarchies know how to replicate, and by replicating, hierarchies have taken over the earth. Tyrannies know how to replicate, and by replicating, they've taken over the earth. Cooperatives have not taken over the earth.
Yeah.
Because each one is different. And each one being different is a beautiful, wonderful thing. But each one being different really impedes the ability of a lot of really exciting, important economic or political systems from being more than just little curiosities. And I want cooperatives to be more than a curiosity. I want there to be a recipe book. But the thing that keeps it going is that to be a successful market or business or hierarchy, you don't really need a certain culture in place. You just need the same rules. And the rules function to minimize the effect of culture and norms on how things play out. In a democracy, in a co-op, the set of rules really interacts closely with a community-specific definition of what's good or what's fair or what's right. And so you can't just copy and paste a set of rules from my community to your community.
No franchise.
But there's no franchising because the rules depend on the norms of the culture, the values of people. And values differ across all kinds of communities, and communities spontaneously get different values. So they need rules that fit their values.
So what you have to have is the franchise of a certain kind of impetus as opposed to a set of rules. You have to have the franchise of a historical moving set of motivations?
Kind of. Yeah. I'm still trying to pin it down. I mean, this is a big question I'm struggling with. How do you franchise a co-op? How do you make co-ops scale in a way that they can really be a viable model around the world? You can't just have a set of rules. You need a process for either building the same culture everywhere, like some onboarding or team building experience or something, or you need a procedure you can follow that, given this or this or this or that set of rule values, here's this or this set of rules that'll fit your values, but that'll lead to the same powerful, exciting, self-governing outcome.
I remember I was once in a dance workshop by Anna Halperin, the famous dancer from the Bay Area who's now in her 90s, and she taught us a few steps and then had someone play the drums, and everybody spontaneously danced together in a way that looked like it was choreographed. she said this is so Bay Area. The people in the Bay Area have what she called extraordinary group awareness, so that we were all able, the group there, to dance together without stepping on each other's toes. And also with making it look like it had been choreographed.
Wow.
And I was thinking about that experience when I was reading your articles and wondering whether it's possible to inculcate extraordinary group awareness in a certain kind of way, so that people actually have, through their experiences, gotten better at self-governance because they're more aware of themselves as a group instead of our individualistic society view we usually have.
Yeah, I struggle. I think I have my own little moral code, my own little sense that gets me through the day of what's right, what's wrong. And I think that depends, its effectiveness depends a lot on the fact that I have a weak personality in the sense that I really care what other people think of me. I really want to be liked. And so my moral code's kind of loose. And for someone who doesn't care about those things, my moral code would permit them to be an awful person. It wouldn't lead to good behavior. So I think a lot of the success of replicating some kind of really coherent, strong, valuable, exciting community is going to be an enculturation process where a bunch of people with really different values or backgrounds kind of become more similar in what's right and wrong. Mm-hmm. But another really important dimension of that community, separate from me changing, is going to be a self-selection where there's 100 types of people. Well, there's 100 communities.
And you should join the right one.
Yeah, you should self-select in the one where people are like you. And it'll run the way it does because everyone in it is by nature super moral or super immoral or whatever. Despite being a bunch of awful people, we have these really strict rules that make us get along and make us build something bigger than each of us could have alone.
Yeah. Well, that's plenty for us to think about. Now, as we do, to end up, I wanted to have you leave the listening audience with one thought question and one action item. So there's a lot of thought questions I think have come up today, but do you have one thought question that you could articulate for the listeners that they might sort of mull over this week then coming out of our discussion?
I think we ended on a pretty good one.
Yeah.
I mean, this idea of social engineering is a really bad thing. And the biggest successes of human social engineering, in my estimation, and most successful in terms of the end product looking a lot like the design, are pretty much, I think they're going to be South African apartheid and the Holocaust. I think those are the two instances of humans actually designing a system that worked the way they intended. Every instance of designing something to turn out good has so many unintended consequences that social engineering has a really bad name. But social engineering is basically what we're looking for if we value democracy and want democracy to replicate. So there's a thought question, is social engineering, how can it be redeemed? Okay. Can it produce anything but awfulness?
Big thought question. And how about one action item? As people go off and do their, as we all live in hundreds of you, each listener probably participates in 20, 30 different self-governing communities, from their family to their department to their people to their who live in their dorm. Or you have some thought for them?
That's it. Yeah, pay attention to the problems you have. Remember that the American society is freakishly individualistic.
Yeah.
Every incentive, every application of technology to make things smaller or more or cheaper is another push away from us knowing how to share. An atrophy of our sharing muscles that the humans were evolved to have. So Americans are freaks by the standards of human history because we're so illiterate in sharing things. So pay attention in your communities when you do have to kind of carpool with someone or trust someone with your kid for 5 minutes. Think of how that problem used to get solved before people could have their own car or even their own house.
Okay. So everybody go forth after the show and share. Okay. Do practice your sharing. Okay. Get in the habit of share a little bit. That sounds like a very good activity. So I want to thank Seth Frye very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
And remind you that you can listen to the show again and on our archive, officehourucdpodcast.com, officehourucdpodcast.com. And underneath it, there will be a link to your website so people can read more about your research. And next week, we will be back to interview somebody else, see what they're doing in their office. In the meantime, stay tuned for Radio Theater, and we'll be back next week. Bye.